During the course of our lives, we forget much more than we remember. The weeks and years can blur together. Names and faces become difficult to recall. But inevitably, there are certain moments we cling on to. Events of significance, breaks in the norm that punctuate our life story. The moments that truly shape us are the ones we could never forget, even if we wanted to. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast that follows the memories of ordinary people, weaving the halls of a long and awful mystery, the unsolved murder of Matt Stewart.
Investigators are trying to figure out who shot a father of three in his own home and why.
The man who murdered my father has never been caught. They have no idea who it is.
The world is a hostile environment.
It was personal. I mean, it was overkill.
There's no hidden lies.
She got a very strange feeling, and she didn't feel safe in her house.
He's going to come back for you, and he's going to come back for your family.
After releasing the first episode, floods of calls and emails came pouring in from around the country, many from folks who had known Matt while he was alive. But a few people had information to pass along, ranging from compelling firsthand accounts to outright rumors. To be honest, what I've learned in the last few weeks has profoundly added to, and in some ways, completely shifted my understanding of this case. But I can't get into all of that right now. But I do want to play you parts of a conversation that I had with the woman who lived down the street from the Stewarts at the time of Matt's murder.
Full name again?
Melissa Champion. We lived at 101 Shepherd Hill Drive. We were taking care of a friend's dog, and we had him in the backyard that particular night. We remember this very well. Our house backed up to woods, and the dog was just barking like crazy. We couldn't figure out why he was going and saying crazy like that, so... My husband, he was out there trying to get it to stop. He just remembers looking at the clock when the dog started going crazy and it being about 12:17. The dog never barked at night. It wasn't something that happened usually.
So the dog wasn't going crazy at what was happening down the street?
No, it was like barking at something.
Like maybe in the woods?
Yeah.
I guess kind of what I'm sensing is perhaps the person that committed this was, you know, running away at that point.
We felt like it could have been.
Where your house was and the Stewart's house, would that be kind of an escape route that you would expect?
The way that would have worked is we had a fence and our neighbor had a fence, but there was a little pathway in between the two fences. And then if you went back into the woods, it took you to the next road. Our initial thought was... maybe he went back there and somebody picked him up. So we got up that morning, got the kids ready for the school, took them to the bus stop. The police were still everywhere. They remembered the SWAT team being there. And we told the police about the dog in our backyard going crazy, but they never really asked us any more questions about it or anything.
Did you ever see them go through your yard or go through to try to...
Nope.
How do you feel about that?
But they didn't take it very seriously. I've never understood it.
So you reported this?
I did. That morning, they were standing at the bus stop.
And they never went through your backyard to check?
Nope, they did
not.
I was home the whole day. At the time, I stayed at home with my kids.
So you would have seen if they went back
there? Yeah, right.
Police didn't follow up on this? I thought investigators thoroughly exhausted every lead, only to come up short. But maybe they didn't perceive Melissa's observation as being relevant. To be fair... when I mapped out where her house was in relation to the site of the murder, it didn't look like the most obvious course someone would take if they wanted to enter or escape the neighborhood undetected. If the assailant had gone through the woods behind Melissa's house, they would have crossed either in front of or behind a number of houses to get there. You'd think this person would be making a beeline for the state highway, not far behind the Stewart's backyard. But then again, nothing about this case is typical to begin with. Home invasions are incredibly rare, especially in Mooresville, and especially ones with no signs of forced entry. So you'd expect investigators to take every report seriously, even those that don't make immediate logistical sense. But let's put a pin in this for now. After all, this is only an anecdote, and there are plenty of abnormalities about this crime scene and investigation that are much more well documented, and we need to cover those first. My favorite teacher from high school was Matthew Bollinger, though I and nearly all of his students affectionately referred to him as Mr. B. Along with his role at the church's affiliated school, Mr. B also served as a pastor at River Life Fellowship, and he was one of Matt Stewart's very best friends. In fact, once upon a time, Mr. B's wife Sarah introduced Matt Stewart to one of her old summer camp pals, Angel, who at the time had just started attending River Life. Just a few months later, Mr. B was officiating Matt and Angel's wedding. The Bollingers and Stewarts remained close for years. Just a week or so before Matt's death, the two families were vacationing together at the beach. In the fall of 2009, I remember Mr. B taking time out of our school's weekly chapel services to recount his experience being one of the first called to the scene of the crime in the wee hours of June 9th. But after 9 years, I can't remember much of the details he shared. Mr. B is now pastoring a new branch of River Life in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And I wondered if he still referenced this experience in his sermons. So I rifled through some of the audio files on his church's website, and I came across a talk he gave near the 6-year anniversary of Matt's murder. Here are some clips from that sermon.
That night, the anniversary is this coming Tuesday, Sarah and I were awakened by a phone call at about 2 a.m. Our friend Angel's dad was on the phone. And all I remember is waking up and hearing Sarah say, "What? Matt's been shot?" A home invasion. A man came into a sleepy little community. Well, you know, Matt was a hero that night because, he was shot 6 times before he ever got out of his bed. But the Spirit of God came over him. He saved his family's life because Angel was holding their little baby, 1-year-old baby, when the guy opened fire on their bedroom. And her arm took a bullet right where the baby was. Their 3-year-old was asleep in the next room. So here, we're on the heels of a major move. You guys have heard us talk about it. A major move of God's Spirit in our church there. Whatever you want to call it, a revival, an outpouring, spending countless hours and nights on the floor under the power of God. Just a glorious time. Let's say 06 to about that time in 09. And I certainly had seen cancers healed and deaf ears open. But on that night, my theology was really rocked. I'm standing over there on this street in the wee hours of the morning with police cars and detectives and my pastor, Byron, trying to make sense. I often have thought about the last conversations I had with Matt. You know, he had been my best friend. Sorry, it'll be a little emotional for me, but, you know, he'd been my best friend for like 10 years. And just a week and a half prior, we'd gotten back from the beach, our families together. I'll never forget a conversation in the car we had about, we were just talking about our marriages. And he was, talking about how difficult his wife was. But of this deep love he had for her and, how with Jesus, it was so good. When I got to know him, he was a struggling young adult. I'm like, I'm just trying to mentor him. I'm like, trying to help him along. I'm like, Matt, what's in your heart? What do you want to do with your life? And he would help us in the youth ministry. I remember one day he goes, "I love kids." A few weeks later, maybe a month or so, he comes back and he goes, "I feel like the Lord's spoken to me. I want to go into nursing school and become a nurse to help kids." And he gave his life to the day of his death. He was ministering to kids and praying for families at Lake Norman Regional Hospital. Squeaky clean guy. I remember the detectives questioning me, trying to find the dirt on Matt Stewart. And I laughed at him. I said, "You're not going to find it. It doesn't exist. He's a godly man." "Yeah, sure. 15 years ago in high school, he did some drugs. But in the last 10, 12 years, there's no hidden life." "Oh, no, no, no. This is always the case. It's always the case. It was somebody he knew. There's something they haven't uncovered." It wasn't true. Still don't believe that.
It had been a while since I last spoke with Mr. B. I decided to give him a call. And over the course of several conversations, he agreed to take me back to the night he and Sarah got that startling call from Angel's dad. Among some of the more interesting tidbits he shared was the time he said it took between police arriving at the scene to actually entering the Stewart's house to get Matt's 3-year-old daughter.
They weren't sure if the if the person who committed the crime was still in the house, thinking maybe there was like a, you know, a hostage situation, concerned about her safety. But they eventually had gone in there. Of course, the person was long gone. I think the person must have left before the police even got there.
Was she out by the time that, I remember you said you got there like at daybreak. Was she out at that point and in custody or?
I'm not sure. I didn't see her. We were kind of like off back down the street a ways. They had the whole area kind of partitioned off. So to be honest with you, I'm not sure at what point they got her out or whatever, where she was. Thank God she was okay. I mean, she just slept through multiple gunshots and could have been far worse. The whole family could have been killed easily.
Angel's dad know that the daughter was still inside?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't remember all the details of what he said. You know, I think he was probably in shock, too. He probably did know something, but that would just be guessing. Things kind of hard to talk about. It's not like I go back and ask them a bunch of other questions about it. Sorry, I don't have all the details of all the ins and outs and chronology of everything.
What made police think this was a hostage situation? And how long was Matt's 3-year-old daughter left alone in that house with the intruder? After our conversation, I did a lot of digging for additional records, and I learned that 911 calls can generate a certain public document called an event report. Mooresville PD provided me with this report, and I was able to confirm what Mr. B said about this delay. The report details that dispatch received Angel Stewart's 911 call at 12:45 a.m. The law goes on to report that officers arrived at the Stewart's house at 12:49. However, it wasn't until 2:30 a.m. that they entered the house, and Matt's daughter wasn't brought out of the house to safety until 2:31 a.m. What the hell happened in those 100 minutes? The document also reveals the special response team was called at 1:24 a.m., presumably to deal with this potential hostage situation. But the report doesn't state when the team arrived or why it was believed or suspected that this situation warranted their presence in the first place.
You know, it's still a bit frustrating. You know, it kind of makes you a little angry with the police department and the detectives.
They immediately started like, okay, let's get the dirt on this guy. And you said that in the in the sermon too. Do you feel like if they would have just kind of believed you guys from the get-go, that
maybe. I mean, but who knows? I mean, I guess that's kind of how you feel about it. It's like, why are you wasting time trying to pursue that angle but I understand, according to, I guess, criminal research, most of the time in something like this, it is like somebody that the person knows or some kind of shady dealings with. But then again, I mean, inevitably, there is the randomness. Random crimes that are done through sheer insanity.
There's something about this killer in South Carolina. Did they ever rule him out?
Are you talking about the Gaffney killer?
Gaffney, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that they ever conclusively ruled him out. And that's part of the frustration. It could have been. Why we don't know that, I don't know. You know, but that's just something that we just had to put in God's hands. Maybe one day we will know.
Do you ever pray about finding justice for Matt?
Yeah. I mean, I believe in divine justice. Nobody gets away with things. I mean, God holds all people accountable, even Matt's murders. You know, I pray for his salvation. That's what Matt would want for him.
Mr. B wasn't the only person in our school who had a close relationship with Matt Stewart. One of my other high school teachers is a guy named Andy Squires, though I've always called him Dr. Squires, after a character in one of my favorite movies. Dr. Squires served as the music pastor at River Life Fellowship. And a few years ago, Squires released an album of songs that he says were inspired in part by the loss of his friend Matt and what the River Life community went through coping with this tragedy.
You wrote this album, beautiful kind of picture of you and the community going through this. And there's one song in particular, What Nobody Should Know. And you talk about driving across the desert canyon, trying to get back home. you know, am I right in saying that that kind of was about getting the news of what happened being across the country?
That's right. So me and Amy and our family were in California when we got the news that Matt had been killed.
I mean, what was going through your mind as far as how could this happen?
Well, the first few days were absolutely the strangest days of my entire life. You never think that you'll be confronted with murder. I think most of us have this idea that car accidents are a possibility, cancer is a possibility. Sometimes things just happen. But murder is like, you never, I don't think anybody sits around imagining having to wrestle with the implications of that. That's not something that I necessarily blame God for. It's more of a description of the way the world is than the way God is. That reality was harder for me to bear than it is for me right now. So that's probably where a lot of those songs came out of.
Mm-hmm.
They came out of me dealing with the miracles and the non-miracles. There's so much to be glad about. The fact that baby was preserved, like he was in the bed when all that went down. And yeah, there was absolute preservation that happened.
Do you think often about, you know, finally putting this case to rest?
No, I don't. I don't think about that at all, actually. You know, our friend Angel has completely moved on with her life. She's an absolute champion, and she's gone on to really pull herself up out of a really dark pit. She's got a beautiful family again, and she's doing really well. So I don't think that any of us kind of sit around waiting for the cops to solve this thing. I know I don't. It's not like I have some type of curiosity that needs to be addressed, you know? Because to me, it doesn't even matter. I don't sit around wondering why anybody would have done this. I mean, it's just such a, it's just evil, you know? Evil is evil. It's just like you can come up with the psychological reasons why somebody does something. But
I mean, do you ever think about if this person is still at large and able to do this to other people?
It's an interesting question, but I've actually never thought of that. Never thought of that. In my mind, I've kind of realized it doesn't matter where you go or what you're doing in this life, you're just vulnerable. The world is a hostile environment, right? It doesn't matter where you go or what you're doing. I think you kind of get to this point where you kind of have to dig into your faith a bit, because the only other option is to fall into despair and to worry all the time. Or I guess you can arm yourself to the teeth and build a bunker in Montana. I guess you could do that.
To a certain extent, we're all vulnerable, but the chances of random acts like this are like getting struck by light. I really hope that one day there's answers, you know, for the family.
My question is, though, what answers are there, though? You know, like, what to hope for those answers, is that, what kind of relief would that actually bring? The only actual true justice would for Matt to be alive today. Everything else is just a pittance.
Well, I know it's coming up on time, and I'll keep you in the loop in terms of where we go with it.
Okay, sounds great.
All right. Love you, buddy.
Love you, too. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
I really appreciated Mr. B and Dr. Squire's willingness to speak with me on a subject I'm sure is still wrought with heavy emotions for them. I had to consider the toll it must have taken on them and their community to have waited for answers for so long, only to come up empty-handed. That had to be disheartening. One member of Matt's family who was there at the scene early that morning was his sister, Mandy. With Hannah's help, I was able to schedule a call with her, and we talked for over an hour.
I don't remember life without him.
Mm-hmm.
Or life before him. We're 2 years, 1 week, and 1 month apart. Growing up, I mean, he was a sports star, super bright, too bright for the school system as it was then. He would get bored, and he would get in trouble because he was bored, but he was just full of energy, and very full of life. He never stopped moving. He was very passionate about children, and he was just a really big kid himself.
How did it all start on June 9th?
I was awake in the middle of the night. I had put a child back to bed, and I had just diapered the other one. So literally everyone was awake. My husband answered the phone, and he just said, "Get dressed. Matt's been hurt." And I remember getting to the scene, and Mom and Dad, and I think my husband told me then, and put their, you know, they kind of encased me in their arms. And I remember screaming pretty loudly. There was blockades. There were blockades. You could only get so close.
There was even some question about whether there was a hostage situation. It took them a while to be able to get in and Therese make sure that she was okay. Did everyone know when you got there that she was okay?
I don't know. I just remember knowing at some point in time they were there.
That they were safe.
Yeah, that they were there and they were safe, but that we couldn't see them or touch them because contaminating evidence. They wouldn't let us see them or touch them. My understanding is she even managed to sleep the entire time.
She slept through the entire...
Yes.
Was law enforcement baffled by that?
I don't know. And you have to realize this is not something that we as a family have all, like, talked about the details. Not because we don't want to. It's just, it's not the way we operate as a family. I have never asked Angel a question. I've never asked Hannah a question. They've never asked me what my experience was. It's usually more on an emotional, grieving level, not details. I've not done that with my parents. I don't know what their experience was that night.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually stayed on the sidewalk until after the sun came up and everybody else was gone. I asked the detective would he let me see him, because I believed that if they would let me see him and they would let me touch him, that I could pray and there would be a different outcome. Not that that's magical thinking. It was my faith. He told me no. He said, "Can't do that. You don't want to see him that way." Before the sun rose, I remember being very angry with the birds for chirping. I said, "What right do you have to be joyful?"
Wow.
And I heard a distinct voice, the Lord say, "Weeping endures for a night, but joy comes in the morning." And that was the verse that I would cling to for the next year.
Mandy and Matt shared a very close bond as siblings. Since his death, Mandy has been one of the curators of Matt's memorial Facebook page, and she works regularly to honor his legacy by sharing pictures and stories from all the chapters of his life.
Do you still cling to hope that justice will be found?
I think that's one of those things that if you keep looking at it from a point of expectation, it'll be a hope deferred and you'll be sick. You package it up and you sit it on the shelf and you say, "Lord, this is yours, because I cannot carry this one. I can't do this." I had the fleeting thought, you know, the other day, would my parents know justice before they pass away? And they're not old, but my grandmother passed away with so much in her heart about the whole thing. You know, I think it's...
Okay.
I think mm-hmm. that was the hope deferred.
And to wonder if this person is still at large and still poses a threat to other families.
I don't even know that has ever genuinely crossed my mind, that they could pose a threat to another family.
Shortly after this happened, there was a shootout in Dallas, North Carolina, where someone was killed and they found out that this person was a spree killer. Do you know if police ever ruled that individual out?
You know, I don't know. That was a real logical possibility at one time. There were a lot of dots to be connected. Actually, I think part of why that wasn't necessarily pursued, even though that person was like working on and I could be wrong about this, working on some houses in my parents' neighborhood the week before. That's part of why it was a possibility. But the nature in which Matt was killed, from what has been explained to me, was far too personal. The violent nature would have lended itself to the idea that this person knew him, even if it was simply in passing. He may have known Matt, Matt may not have known him.
Was there anyone at all that you could think of that might want to do something like that, that was, you know, in his life?
Not anybody that I would think that was malicious or would want to hurt him or that he had crossed ways with. There is another aspect of that I cannot share with you, unfortunately, partly because I don't, how do I say that? There was a person that we knew that we, that people in the community instantly drew some conclusions, but that person was cleared. And I cannot express anything else about that, just because I think that would cause undue. I'm starting to feel uncomfortable. I feel like I'm saying things that my family may not be okay with. So,
sure.
I feel like I might need to go a different direction with some of this.
Sure. No. We could certainly change the topic. I'm.
Some stories lie hopelessly shrouded in hearsay and mystery. And those of us interested in learning the truth dig for it. Next month, we'll dive deeper into the public records available on Matt's murder. We'll enlist the help of experts, including Dr. Carol Lieberman, a world-renowned forensic psychologist, medical doctor, and legal analyst who's worked on famous cases like the Jenny Jones talk show murder. We're incredibly grateful to have her and others lend their expertise in evaluating the facts of this case that has remained unsolved for far too long. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, with audio production and backing tracks by myself and the irresistibly handsome Matt Garrett. Special thanks to Melissa Champion, Matthew Bollinger, Andy Squires, and Mandy Cook for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.